Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have an exciting episode for you on the obscure and hidden topic of deep underground bases with the top expert in the field, Dr. Richard Sauder. Now, Dr. Sauder's key discoveries are outlined in his controversial book, Hidden in Plain Sight. In the book, Sauder draws upon declassified documents and compelling anecdotal testimony from whistleblowers to paint a fascinating picture of a massive global infrastructure of underground bases. These installations form a completely secret world of military experiments and UFO technology. Is it possible that there's an entirely invisible culture being developed underground without the public's knowledge or consent? Let's go ask Dr. Richard Sauder.
There's so much more involved here than I had suspected. And we're talking about technology and personnel and programs.
The Dark Journalist Special Report. The Secret World of Underground Bases. Featuring an in-depth two-part interview with Hidden in Plain Sight author Dr. Richard Sauder. Now, let's join Dark Journalist Daniel List.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the special report on deep underground bases with Richard Sauder. Richard, it's great to have you here. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Of course, I'm a huge fan of all the work that you've done investigating these deep underground structures and the hidden infrastructure that's been developed with it and kept totally secret. Now, before we get started, I'd like to ask you what you've been up to lately and what have you been writing, and also to give us an idea in your own words of what your research is really all about.
I have many postings on my blog in recent years, including in this year, on a great variety of topics. And I expose information, some of which you're likely not to read elsewhere. And I have written about and researched the topic of underground and underwater bases and tunnels.
Yes, and your work has really set the tone for deep research in this highly compartmentalized subject. Now, I want to point out here that your blog is available at eventhorizonchronicle.blogspot.com. People can keep up with you and your latest writing there. It's great research. And I want to mention here that I do think it's a learning curve for an average person to accept the reality that there's all this activity and all this construction, a whole different world going on underground, and that they never get to see it. They have no knowledge about it. So I want to get into that with you here, because I do think that that's an important piece of the puzzle, which is making our reality big enough to see these other realities happening.
Well, and one of the other factors, Daniel, is that ignorance reigns these days.
Yes.
More and more people are more and more deeply ignorant about more and more things with each passing year. And I don't know how to explain the lack of intellectual curiosity in the great spasm or paroxysm of society-wide stupidity, but there you go. It is what it is.
Right, absolutely. And a lot of this dumbing down is by design. There's no doubt about it. Now, one thing I find interesting is that you moved from the U.S. to Ecuador. So how are you finding it down there? Now, do you think since people there are kind of out of reach from some of this American propaganda from the mainstream media, do you feel like they're a little more conscious in general?
Yes and no. Ecuador is still very much a sort of American colony, mm-hmm. in that the country uses the American dollar. There are billions of dollars of trade with the United States. There are hundreds of thousands of expatriate Ecuadorians who have emigrated to the United States, live and work in the United States, and send monthly payments back home. And then there are American movies are pervasive in Ecuador. American television programs also run on Ecuadorian television. So there's quite a lot of saturation of American culture in Ecuador. There's a lot of American used clothing worn by Ecuadorians with American logos of American sports teams or Hollister College, etc. So there's quite a large American influence in South America.
Well, that's really interesting. And we know there are major efforts to control the media in other countries as well. Now, one of the things I find fascinating in your books is that when looking at the origin of some of this modern, say, 20th century underground development, you track back some of this to the Nazi efforts in this area of developing major infrastructure underground. If we're looking for the roots of developing this underground world, do you think that this kind of activity, you know, the tunnel building, started with the Nazis?
Actually, you can go back further than that, though the Nazis did raise it to another level.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Rock of Gibraltar, for example, is tunneled out. It is honeycombed like Swiss cheese and has been for centuries because it has a very militarily strategic position at the mouth of the Mediterranean Sea. And so, and then going back in between World War I and World War II, you had the French who created the famous Maginot Line, which was a miles long military working, underground mostly, of train lines, barracks, munition stores, artillery emplacements, etc. And it ran for miles in eastern France. The intent was to prevent another German invasion. Of course, it failed. The Germans knew where it was, so they simply marked X on the map where the Maginot Line was and drove around the end of it and never confronted directly the Maginot Line. However, the Germans did take note of what the French had done in the 1920s and 1930s and themselves constructed underground workings on their eastern front, mostly what would be today in Poland, and called the Regenwurmslager, which was a very extensive series of underground train lines, barracks, gun emplacements, etc., just ran for miles and miles across the countryside. And then they also constructed many other underground military facilities and industrial facilities during, just before and during World War II. And so after, towards the, midway in the war, or about two-thirds of the way through, Hitler appointed Xaver Dorsch head of his underground bases program, which is quite extensive and elaborate. And then, of course, in the spring of 1945, the Third Reich was militarily overrun by the Russian armies and the American armies, and that put an end to that phase of German underground base construction. And Xaver Dorsch was then taken into custody by the American army and was debriefed by them on his civil engineering activities for the TOT organization, which was analogous in the Nazi system to the Army Corps of Engineers and the Navy Seabees in the American military system. And he was in American military custody for a period of years. I know they debriefed him. I got some of his debriefing documents, a couple of them, that made it to the public record. I'm quite sure the great deal more remains classified. And then in the post-World War II period, the Americans themselves, the American military industrial program, began what they called their underground plant program. And from what I can see and my research suggests, that continues to the present day and has been and is very extensive.
Yeah, well, with World War II ending over 70 years ago, absolutely. We can only imagine the vastness of this huge program. And in your book, which is really a fascinating read, there are hints, and one of them that you have in there, which I think is powerful, was a kind of offhand remark by a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers official. And I think his name was Lloyd Dusha. Is that his name?
Yes.
Well, he let out something very interesting, which you picked up on and included there in the book. Now, can you get into his comment here?
Yes, he of course, was the deputy director of engineering and construction for the United States Army Corps of Engineers back in the 1980s. And the underground excavation industry, like all industries from time to time, from place to place, has professional conferences. And he was invited to speak at one of those conferences at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in 1987. Had a conference on civil engineering, underground engineering, and excavation. He was one of the speakers at that conference, and in his talk, which was entitled "Underground Facilities for Defense: Experience and Lessons." So you know, whatever he says in his talk, he's talking about underground military facilities. And I'll just read briefly some of the things he said. After World War II, political and economic factors changed the underground construction picture and caused a renewed interest to think underground. As a result of this interest, the Corps of Engineers became involved in the design and construction of some very complex and interesting military projects, understanding that given the focus of the conference, he's talking about very complex and interesting military projects underground.
Okay.
And then he says that although the conference program has to do with underground facilities for defense, experience and lessons, I must deviate a little because several of the most interesting facilities that have been designed and constructed by the Corps are classified. Right there, he's telling you that there are several secret military underground bases.
Right, right.
He's saying that in black and white on the public record. Not one or two, but several of the most interesting facilities of this kind are classified. And then he goes on to say that, as I stated earlier, there are other projects of similar scope to the NORAD base beneath Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado, but which included multiple chambers up to 50 feet wide and 100 feet high, using the same excavation procedures mentioned for the NORAD facility. So what he is saying in black and white on the public record in everyday English is that we, the military, the United States Army Corps of Engineers, have made multiple large, deep, underground, sophisticated, complex facilities. That right there is an open admission of secret underground bases.
Yeah. Wow, that is surprising, really, that he just let that out. And that was a really good catch on your part also.
I caught it because I started all the way back at World War II in the mid-1940s, actually the late 30s, early 40s, and went through the technical, military, scientific, engineering, and academic literature having to do with underground and underwater construction. And I came forward from there exhaustively.
Right.
And it took me a long time. And so I was going through conference proceedings, everything. And that's how I caught that, just because I was reading everything. I mean, I was going through myriad thousands of pages of obscure literature.
Yes. Well, it does sound like a major effort. And it's interesting because they are somehow obligated to put this information out there, you know, obscured as it is in all of these nested details. So it actually takes the kind of meticulous research that you're talking about, which isn't easy and takes a lot of time and resources. And that kind of research that you've done, that's what it takes to actually be able to find it anything of importance or anything of substance at all.
Yes, and almost no one does that these days. Very few people do. And so while there is a paper trail, almost no one goes in deeply into the federal documents, the technical documents, the military documents, the think tank documents, the engineering journals, the conference proceedings. And there are just thousands and thousands, tens and hundreds of thousands of these documents, and it takes a great deal of time to sift through them. And I can tell you from having been in a good number of archives and technical document repositories and large research libraries over the years, that there were many times when I would be in musty, the stacks of musty documents collections, going through documents from the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and I would spend hours and days in that environment and not see another living soul. Or, having done that, I would find a document of interest and pick it up and look at it and discover that I was the only person ever having looked at it, because depending on the printing procedure, sometimes the edges you have to separate with a knife or with a letter opener to separate the pages to read what's there. And no one had ever done that in 60 years.
Wow. That is really unbelievable.
Well, that's why I say we live in a society, and why not talk about American society, that is, people are not intellectually curious. They do not research. Most of them do not read anything, ever. There are a lot of people who have not read one book in their life.
It is surprising. And as we said earlier, a lot of this dumbing down is engineered by design. The glorification of celebrity culture is certainly a part of that. But we do have to ask why that desire for distraction is so great. All that aside, I do wonder how an average person would feel if they understood the kind of gravity, the scope, the extent, and the intricacy of the secret worlds of underground bases that we're discussing here. I mean, I think they would be shocked.
Well, I don't know. You know, that's one of the things that I don't know. I can tell you they understand that nuclear weapons are there, and that they can be deployed on a five-second notice with apocalyptic consequences. That's public knowledge and has been public knowledge for more than half a century. And knowing that, the average person does nothing. I mean, does nothing about it. So I have to wonder if they knew about the full extent of the underground bases, if they would do anything about that either. I find that most people are very passive, willfully ignorant. They work at being ignorant. It takes great effort to know little or nothing. You have to work at that. You have to go out of your way to know nothing, because we're surrounded by information.
Well, that's really true. A lot of the information is there if you're willing to find it. And that brings us back to your research, because you've developed some very interesting sources along the way.
Yes.
And one of them was this illustrator. Interesting guy. He was a former Navy artist. And you actually included some of his illustrations in your book. Walter Kirschner, is that right?
Yes. Walter Kirschner, yes.
Yeah, these illustrations are fascinating because they had to be these bases that were on the drawing board. And right there was the artist who was assigned to draw them. So that's probably as close to a glimpse of these underground bases as we're ever going to get.
Well, yes. In fact, I spoke with a number of people who were associated with that research and development project for the United States Navy back in the 1960s. You're referring to the so-called Rock Site program, where the United States Navy, this was under the direction of John Pena Craven, who was the Navy's chief research officer during the height of the Cold War. John Pena Craven was tasked with the Navy High Command with developing the ability to work and operate at a deep sea level in mid-ocean at 20,000 feet beneath the sea. He was tasked with moving the United States Navy into an active posture where they could work and operate at 20,000 feet beneath the sea. And he did that. One of the projects they worked on was the Rocksite project, and the development for that took place at China Lake Naval Weapons Station out in the desert in California. And then the object was to make manned bases down in the bedrock beneath the seafloor well out to sea. I mean, we're talking going out to sea 500 miles or 1,000 miles. In other words, in the middle of the Atlantic or the Gulf of Mexico or the Pacific Ocean. And tunneling, building tunnels under the sea, and also manned bases, and then stationing nuclear missiles out there, submarines and their crews. The objective was to actually take multiple large military submarines into these deep sea, undersea bases, and stationing submarines and their crews out there, having nuclear missile fields actually embedded in the seafloor. The Stanford Research Institute, which is one of the main military industrial think tanks, very much like the Rand Corporation or the Battelle Institute, there are a number of these, and the Stanford Research Institute is one of them. They also, back in the 1960s, about 1968 or so, were also doing some research and design work on this policy, and projecting that a 30 deep sea underground or undersea bases could be built for us just several billion dollars.
Wow.
And that you could have permanently manned bases, or you could use these for research facilities, or you could station nuclear missiles in these bases undersea. So I found two different sources in my search through the paper trail for those building those bases, both reaching back to the United States military industrial complex, whether it was the SRI or the United States Navy in the 1960s. I therefore am assuming, since this was being actively researched and designed and planned at a reasonably high level within the American military-industrial complex 50 years ago, I'm assuming that it has been done.
Yeah, well, I think you're right to assume that. Now, what do you think is the primary function of that whole secret underground base world? You know, is it strictly for military application?
No, it's not purely military, and there is not just one primary function. There are multiple facilities. We don't know the true number. As I said at the outset of the interview, there are certainly secret facilities that remain classified. The quote from Lloyd Dusha suggests that they are complex and interesting. So let your imagination run.
Yeah.
But we do know there are an unknown number of complex, interesting military underground bases. We also, my research points to the probability of secret Fortune 500 facilities as well. There are certainly other groups involved. Any group or individual or organization that has, at a minimum, a few hundreds of millions of dollars could feasibly construct underground or undersea bases. I'll give you an example.
Okay, great.
During my research, I was contacted by a guy. This is before 9/11, just before 9/11, who told me that he worked in the business of providing supplies used in constructing deep underground facilities in the mining industry. So, for example. And I said, yeah, well, that's interesting. Why are you contacting me? He said, well, because the type of equipment I provide is used in buttoned-up facilities underground. In other words, where you have to have an enclosed life support system. And I said, go on. He said, yes, well, I was contacted to provide this technology for a company that was making a facility in the Gulf of Mexico region. And I said, well, what do you mean by in the Gulf of Mexico region? Near the Gulf of Mexico or actually in the Gulf of Mexico? And he said, in the Gulf of Mexico. I said, as in down in below in the seafloor? And he said, yes. And I said, well, okay. So then you're telling me that this organization was making a manned facility beneath the seafloor of the Gulf of Mexico. He said, correct. And I said, all right, how do you know that? He said, because of the type of equipment it is used only for situations where you are on a contained life support system without connection to the outside atmospheric envelope. And it was actually in the Gulf of Mexico. And I said, well, what was the organization's name? And he said, Parsons. Hmm. Well, of course, Parsons is one of the major engineering firms in the United States. And they've been heavily involved with a lot of underground projects. They certainly would have the technological and engineering expertise and base to make an undersea facility. So, and then 9/11 happened, and people got real quiet, a lot of my sources, because a lot of them are working for three-letter agencies or for engineering firms that are contracting with espionage agencies or military agencies, and everything just got real quiet after 9/11. It got harder to talk to people.
Yeah, I can imagine that must have made looking into this a lot harder, although you got some great information from him and from others. Another one of your really intriguing sources, what I think was the most interesting one, was a kind of disembodied one.
Yes, yes.
And he originally contacted you electronically by voice with no apparatus on your end. And later on, you got confirmation on who this individual was. Now, can you tell that story here? It's really interesting.
Yes. I had started my research in the early 1990s. And after looking into the topic a little bit, because I'd heard people talking about it in an offhand way, I found that there were some underground bases that I could publicly identify, and wrote a short article for UFO magazine in Los Angeles, which is now now defunct, sadly, but in its day it was a great magazine.
I remember it, yes.
Yes. At that time, Don Ecker and Vicki Cooper, who I believe and hope are still together, were running the magazine, along with Sherry Stark. I believe she was in the loop in those days as well. And I published a little article in their magazine. It came out in about November of 1992. And at that point, I thought that I had exhausted the topic. So I was in a very intensive doctoral degree program right then, and I didn't have time to research the topic more at that time. However, after the article appeared in the first week of November of 1992, nothing happened for a few weeks, several weeks. And then in the week between Christmas and New Year's of 1992, that's dead week in the academic world, I was sleeping soundly. And one night, and in the wee hours of the morning, maybe 2 o'clock or something like that, I was suddenly awakened, and I didn't know why. I was laying on my back in bed in the dark with total lucidity. I was extremely physically relaxed, but suddenly, consciously, very wide awake, and I was wondering why. I wasn't groggy in the slightest. Suddenly, I heard a voice speaking very quietly, yet matter-of-factly, and distinctly in my ear. It was like having an earbud or a little earpiece in your ear. And the voice was that of an adult male speaking educated late 20th century North American English. He began by telling me the underground bases are real, Well, that's an attention-grabbing line.
It definitely is. And when we come back, we'll get into the highly unusual dialogue that you had with this high-level individual and what you think he may have been up to imparting this really powerful information to you about these deep underground bases. We're also going to get into these elements of the breakaway civilization that are involved and the ultimate question of some of these bases having a major UFO connection. We're coming back with round two of part one with Richard Sauter. Stay with us.
Dark Journalist subscribers renew early and save. For a limited time, you can go to darkjournalist.com/renew and renew your subscription at the discount rate of just $39 for one full year. Lock in last year's discount for a savings of $30 and get the shows you want to hear at this special discount. Don't miss out. Renew early and save by going to darkjournalist.com/renew or use the renew link on the member page. See you there.
We are back. This is Dark Journalists, and we're going to get right back into this powerful overview on deep underground bases with Dr. Richard Sauter, the author of the groundbreaking book, Hidden in Plain Sight. This is just a really thorough look at some incredible infrastructure that the public knows very little about. So I highly recommend this book. I want to take a moment here to remind everyone to sign up for our newsletter at darkjournalist.com so you don't miss any of the exciting shows we have coming up for you in 2017. Now, Richard, we were just getting into this very unusual contact that you had with a disembodied electronic voice giving you this secret information. Now, what I'm curious about is, what was your reaction to all this? You know, upon hearing this, did you think this is a dream, or did it sound like a real man's voice? What were you thinking?
I realized immediately when I heard his voice that I was hearing the voice of a real man. I never then or now for once entertained the notion that it was the voice of a demon or an angel or of God or of an extraterrestrial or of a spirit or that I was losing my mind. I sensed immediately that it was a real person speaking to me by some, undoubtedly some technological means. And I instantly understood what he was talking about because it's something that I had recently written about. And so just that fast in the snap of the fingers, the snap of your fingers, I understood all of that. He went on to say, and I listened quietly and attentively, that indeed there are underground bases, secret underground bases, that there are a good number of them, that they can be quite large and deep and accommodate a lot of people, and that there are programs and projects being carried out underground that people would just be astonished to know about. But in fact, they don't know about them, and so out of sight, out of mind. And he went on and talked in this vein for 2 or 3 minutes, and then he stopped just as abruptly as he had begun. And I was left lying there thinking, oh my, you know, there's so much more involved here than I had suspected. You know, there was what I had found in my research, but so much more. Because what he had described to me was large and extensive in scope. And we're talking about technology and personnel and programs and projects and plans. And it was just very extensive in scope and size. And I was just thinking, oh, God, you know, this is big.
Yeah.
And so then the next morning, I remembered clearly what had happened during the night. And I determined, you know, given what he told me, there has to be a paper trail. Because there's got to be bureaucracy involved in this, government, companies, organizations, you know, just a lot of stuff involved in this. And there's got to be a paper trail, and some of it has to have fallen through the tracks, because what he was what he was downloading to me was big. I mean, we're talking big with capital B, capital I, capital G. And so I went out and I looked for the paper trail. And Daniel, by God, I found the paper trail. I found it, and I never came to the end of it.
Oh, right, right. Yeah.
I mean, there are major companies and corporations involved. There are government agencies. There are think tanks. There are military agencies. I mean, just it's like a hydra, you know. There are heads everywhere. There are extensions and tentacles everywhere. It's big. It's decades long. There are a lot of people involved, a lot of agendas.
Wow. Well, it is an amazing contact, and it kind of brings us back to this question of what are the main purposes behind the people putting this secret world together?
Well, some of those are military, whether it's command and control facilities like Site R on the border between Maryland and Pennsylvania, or Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado. Those would be two of the best known command and control facilities. A non-military command and control facility would be Mount Weather, which is the big FEMA underground base in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
Then there are others. There are other military facilities where, I mean, there are a lot of nuclear weapons underground. There are underground weapon storage facilities. There are also, in terms of other government agencies, there are facilities, government facilities that store records underground, of all kinds. There are, in when you're talking about industrial facilities, there are underground hydroelectric facilities, for example. There are underground nuclear waste facilities like WIPP in New Mexico, which, by the way, has massively failed and is now in a very serious failure mode, which for the most part is kept out of the mainstream news media.
Yes, that's very dangerous stuff indeed. And this story kind of surfaces and then goes away from time to time. You know, we heard a lot about a radioactive drum blowing up in New Mexico 2 years ago, and then it got very quiet. And a staggering stat that came out of that, and maybe the reason why they kept it so quiet, is that it cost $2 billion to contain the whole thing. Just amazing. Now, what other kinds of underground industry is there?
There are underground scientific research facilities. So those are some examples that you can find pretty readily from the open literature, whether it's scientific literature, engineering literature, industrial engineering, or military literature.
Right. And the devil's in the details with some of these, I'm sure. You know, they may be listed for a certain type of purpose, like storage, for example. But we can only imagine what they're actually used for. Now, what is a good example that you've found in the U.S. for a major underground base here?
There's a huge, I mean, when I say large, I mean very large and deep underground facility beneath the White House in Washington, D.C., and it's been there for a long time, at least a half a century, if not more.
Wow, and as I understand it, it was vast in JFK's time, so we can only imagine what it's like now. Now, is there anything comparable to that overseas in some of these other major countries?
There are many, many facilities of many types in many areas of the world. The United States has many of them. There are other countries with them. The Swiss Alps are said to be tunneled like Swiss cheese.
That's amazing.
The French have underground facilities. The British do. The Chinese do. The Russians do. I give examples of some of these in my books, but my books are focused on the United States.
Yes, well, I can appreciate that. Now, you mentioned that one just a moment ago that was beneath the White House, and you interviewed someone who had actually been inside of it, who gave you a fascinating description of what was going on there. Now, can you tell us about her and what she said?
Yes, and suddenly we have a lot of distortion on Skype as you ask that question.
Yeah, well, I'm getting an echo now, but we should be okay.
Let me tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, please continue.
Yes, okay. That's true. It was actually a woman I knew well, now deceased, who grew up in the Mid-Atlantic region and went to school at one of the universities in Washington, D.C., and graduated back in the 1960s and took an entry-level job with HUD, the Housing and Urban Development, Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Oh, yeah.
That was in the mid-1960s. Lyndon Johnson was the president then, John F. Kennedy having been assassinated in November of 1963.
Right.
So she took an entry-level job with HUD and was at her desk one day there in Washington, D.C., when suddenly two Secret Service men showed up at her desk, flashed their credentials, and said, "Are you Miss So-and-so?" And she said, "Well, yes, I am." And they said, "Would you come with us?" And she said, "Well, why?" And they said, "Well, your presence is requested at the White House." And she was flabbergasted. Of course, her thought was, little old me, but why? But they were very adamant that she had to go with them. And so she did. They went across town to the gates of the White House, to like the guard gate at the White House. And that was it. She merely had to report to the guard post at the White House, and they told her she could return to her job.
Okay.
Well, she returned to her job with her head swimming. And I must tell you, as you get into this research, you hear one bizarre story after another, and it gets stranger and stranger the deeper you go into it. But nonetheless, that was her initial reaction. How strange. Why me? What's this all about? It made no sense to her, and the Secret Service gave her no explanation.
Huh.
Well, she put it out of her mind. Sometime later, the same thing happened again, and she once again was flabbergasted. But the Secret Service agents had some documents with them. They gave the documents to her and said, "You are to deliver these documents to the White House." And of course, she was thinking, well, if they are the Secret Service and they work at the White House, why don't they just deliver the documents themselves?
Exactly.
Why am I required to go deliver the documents? They again provided no explanation to her, simply said that she must accompany them and that she must deliver the documents to the White House. So she again went with them. Her head was swimming. She understood none of it, and they didn't explain any of it to her. So they went again to the guard post at the White House, only this time she was ushered through the gate and up the driveway to the White House and into the White House, and was taken by these agents to an elevator within the White House and ordered to get in, which she did. She got in the elevator, and she remembers that the elevator went not up but went down 17 levels. When the doors opened underground, there were other federal agents waiting for her. And in front of her was a corridor, a hallway, that extended to the vanishing distance, to the vanishing point in the distance. She couldn't see an end of it. The corridor was tiled. Ceiling, walls, and floor were tiled with recessed fluorescent lighting.
That's pretty wild.
So that's she couldn't see an end to it. It just vanished in the distance. And off of the corridor were other hallways and corridors and doorways all up and down the line. Presumably, they were just levels like this pancake going down. Because she went to the 17th level, and this was in about 1966, something like that.
That far back there.
Almost half a century ago.
Yes.
And she was then ushered by the other federal agents down this corridor a ways to one of the doorways. And they opened the door. They took her in, and it was an office. There was another federal agent sitting at a desk in the office. All of these guys were in suit and tie. She was ordered by her escort to give the documents to the man behind the desk, which she did. She was then escorted out of that office, back into the corridor, down the corridor by these other agents, which work underground, to the elevator. The elevator came back down. She was put in the elevator. She went back topside and was handed off to other federal agents in the White House, who then took her back down the driveway to guard post, and she was handed off there to the guards and was signed out of the White House and told that she was free to go about her business. And she never knew, neither was she told, what it was all about.
Wow, what a puzzle for her. And it leads us to all kinds of questions about what was really happening there. Now, is she and her story what led you to investigate the White House underground base?
I did do research after I had that anecdotal story and found out that indeed, already beginning in the Eisenhower years, there was an organization called the Military Office. It's an independent agency within the government that is at the, it's like the president's own Praetorian Guard, only much more so than for a Roman emperor. The Military Office, which started way back in the post-World War II era, has an unlimited slush fund. The president, at his beck and call, can call upon unlimited bureaucracy, money, personnel, and total secrecy to do almost anything he wants. And the thing that Eisenhower wanted was a series of deep underground bunkers, unknown numbers of them. But one of the ones was beneath the White House. There were others made across the country. Many of them still remain classified to this day. And that extended up through the years and continues down to the present day. In recent years, that facility under the White House has been added to, extended, updated, what you will.
Well, we've heard rumors about it, that it may exist beneath the entire D.C. area. And we know that things were buried deep, right back to the founding of the United States of America. Could something that large actually exist beneath a major city?
Its true extent is unknown. Let's just say it's very large. Even then, half a century ago, it was very large and very deep. I would presume that it's, however big and deep it was then, that it is bigger and deeper now.
Yeah, absolutely. With the advanced technology, 50 years means they're light years ahead of what was happening in the 60s, so far beyond us we can't even imagine. Now, you did find some tantalizing clues to a completely operational large-scale command center to replace the normal chain of authority. And this might lead us into some of the COG planning that's so obscure and secretive.
And I cover that in Hidden in Under, Hidden in Plain Sight, Beyond the X-Files, is that starting in the late Kennedy administration and extending into the Johnson years was a plan called for the so-called DUCC, D-U-C-C, Deep Underground Command Center.
Okay.
Which was planned to be built 3,500 feet deep below the White House, with connecting access elevators and tunnels, also from the State Department and the Pentagon. And this facility would be accessed by elevators, 3,500 foot deep elevators, and then an underground train system. Everything that I have seen suggest strongly that this has been made.
Wow, that is incredible. And when you're talking about that kind of depth, I'm reminded of this wave of unusual stories about these cities and towns across America experiencing these strange booms. And Linda Moulton Howe, for example, has done some extraordinary work reporting on this. Now, whenever these waves hit, I wonder, are these rumbling, thunderous booms that we keep seeing reports on from Connecticut to California related to the large-scale development of underground bases?
Let me address that. The answer is, yes, I think that some of this booming activity could be related to underground construction. I'll give you one example, and that is that during the George W. Bush years, when Dick Cheney was vice president of the United States,
right,
there were quite a lot of large booms reported beneath the vice president's mansion in Northwest Washington, D.C. The booming went on for not just months, more than a year, I believe. I cover this in the book as well. He wasn't living there at the time. This was covered. There was also a lot of that went on down by the Lincoln Memorial near the Reflecting Basin at the same time. The vice president's mansion is actually a naval reservation. It's on the grounds of the United States Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. So that construction activity was carried out by the United States Navy or contractors working for them. At the same time, the United States Navy was also carrying out another major unexplained, very secret construction program right on the shores of the Potomac River on the other side of Washington, D.C. And in that particular project, a company called Kiewit was heavily involved, K-I-E-W-I-T. Kiewit, for decades, has been a major contractor for federal agencies and United States military agencies on major underground excavation projects. So the activity of Kiewit is a dead giveaway that the underground network beneath Washington, D.C. was being upgraded and expanded during the George W. Bush, Dick Cheney years.
Wow.
And yes, there were numerous loud explosions or booms connected with that construction project. Now, how many people routinely use, dynamite for construction projects at their home? No one.
Yeah.
So you connect those dots. The mainstream news media didn't, but they're obvious.
No question. It's getting harder and harder to hide this other society, this breakaway civilization, and their advanced technology. And that leads to the whole issue of where this technology is coming from, which leads us to the underground UFO bases, which you've done a great job tracking, and how this whole reverse-engineered UFO technology is above nuclear secrecy in the command chain. Now that is top secret. And we're going to get into the possibility of alien involvement in the deep underground bases. You've done the research, and I'm looking forward to what you have to say about this and the forces in this breakaway national security state.
Right.
So we'll end part one here and go for part two, which Dark Journalist subscribers will get in their inbox next week. Now is the time to subscribe at darkjournalist.com. And Richard's book, Hidden in Plain Sight, available at eventhorizonchronicle.blogspot.com. Richard, thank you for some great information today.
My pleasure, Daniel.
All right. Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode on the secret world of deep underground bases with Dr. Richard Sauter. You can find more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Thinking of subscribing but haven't gotten around to it yet? Now is the perfect time to become a member of Dark Journalist. For a limited time, you can lock in last year's discount of $39 for one full year. That's $30 off the regular price and includes the high-quality audio files, HD video, bonus show material, and more. Go to darkjournalist.com and subscribe today.